Well done. That's a long reading. We're going to look at it and think about the implications of it for us. There's actually some headings on the inside of your sheet, which will hopefully be a help to you. We're carrying on this series in the life of Jacob, God's trickster. And this is where we've got to. And I want to begin with asking a question, as I often do. And the question is this: what about when God's people are the problem? And some of us already know what I'm talking about. Sometimes this is very relevant to us. There's an old ditty which says, "To dwell above with saints we love, that will be grace and glory. To live below with saints we know, that's quite another story." And we hear the little ditty and we smile because, you know, we know about the foibles, eccentricities, imperfections of the people sitting near us, and we grow to love them over time and we kind of laugh about them. But sometimes it's not just little imperfections we're talking about. Sometimes it is serious sins, the kind of sins which wrong people in such profound ways that you know things can never be the same again. And maybe some of us, that has been our experience in church. We've come across real hypocrisy, real abuse sometimes. I was reflecting this fortnight actually about my own experience with seeing church leaders. When my wife and I, Josie, got married 20 years ago, there were four Christian leaders who we invited to the wedding. Three of them are now disgraced for various reasons. The vicar, who was my vicar for the first 20 years when I was growing up, is now in prison. And then in the last fortnight, I've discovered that the Christian leader who gave us marriage preparation at that time has in the last 2 weeks been in the national press, and many women are accusing him of sexual assault. Maybe you've got your own stories. You've seen real problems in the church and you've seen them right up close. Perhaps even worse, even closer than seeing them at church, you've experienced them in a Christian family. Perhaps you were in a family where everything seemed okay on the outside, but those on the inside knew it was very different. But sometimes, and this is a very different kind of issue, we experience the situation where I am the problem. What about if the wickedness isn't just in the same community as me or under the same roof? What about when it's actually here? What about when I'm the problem? You'll probably know one of the very simplistic and easy ways people go through life is they analyze our world into goodies and baddies. And you can do it in different ways. There's the people like us. We're basically what's right in the world. And then there's the people like them who are the problem. And the us and them system, tribalism, it works very well for a while. You know, you can do it along various lines. You could define people ethnically or nationally or religiously. In our country, very often we define people politically. There's the right thinking people like me. And then there's the ignorant or the haters. That is not the way the Bible analyzes humanity at all. And the Bible's analysis is much more profound and much more unsettling. As the Russian writer and Nobel laureate Alexander Solzhenitsyn summarized it, he said this: "The lines separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties, but right through every human heart." And that's what we're going to see today in our reading from the Bible. And what we're going to see is this: we're going to see the mess that sin creates, even amongst the people of God. And then we're going to conclude by considering how God's purposes still win, and actually why that is our hope and our comfort, even in the midst of the mess. So what we're going to do, we're going to go through each of the four people who were in our passage. There's two parents, Isaac and Rebecca. And then there's the two twins. There's the hairy, outdoorsy one, Esau, and the smooth and devious one, who I thought maybe is a bit like Thor and Loki. Anyway, the first up we're going to look at is Esau, the hairy one, whose indifference costs him everything. Now, the passage that we just had read is basically about a wickedness that is done to Esau. And he's going to be very angry about it, and he's going to paint himself as the righteous victim. And of course, if this passage was all we had, than we would agree, you know, poor Esau. But interestingly, the writer frames the whole account with a reminder at both ends of our passage, actually, of what kind of a person Esau really was. We get it in chapter 26, 34, and then we get it at the end of the passage in 28, verse 9, and we see Esau taking multiple unbelieving wives. And actually, that's no surprise if we've been reading through the story. This is really typical of the Esau we know. Esau, we've seen, is basically indifferent to God, indifferent to what God says is valuable. What God says matters doesn't really matter to him. And we saw this, if you were with us 2 weeks ago, we saw it playing out in his life. And we saw this is why he ultimately loses everything which counts. And this passage is the outworking of the decisions he made in chapter 25. Next up, so after Esau, we're looking at the dad, Isaac. He's quite like Esau, and he puts appetite over promises. If you're with us last week, we're in chapter 26. We looked at the life of Isaac, and actually we saw quite a positive picture of Isaac's life. And yet here we're seeing that as Isaac got towards the end of his life, we're in his final years now, his appetites gradually got the better of him. And he ends up in his later years basically being ruled by his stomach. We saw back in 25:23 that before Esau and Jacob were born, God declared his purpose, which is this: the older shall serve the younger. So we know what God's purpose is for this family. The idea is that Jacob, not Esau, will receive the blessing. And Isaac knew that. He knew that the younger son was the one God had chosen to inherit the blessing. And what's more, as we've already seen, he had seen that Esau had repeatedly shown himself to be indifferent to God and his purposes, and therefore Esau was not a worthy recipient of the blessing. And despite knowing all that, the dad, Isaac, as he senses his death is approaching, there in verse 2, he selects Esau as his preferred candidate. He's the one who he wants to receive the blessing, in direct defiance of what God has purposed should happen. It's worth saying, if you haven't been with us in the series, the blessing in this context is the declaration of the Lord's blessing. It's the blessing that was first given to Abraham, and then it was given, passed down to Isaac, and it will now be passed on to one of Isaac's sons. It's the privilege of being the one whose offspring will one day save the world. It's a great blessing. And the reason why Isaac chooses Esau is because he loves the food that Esau makes for him. We read that outright in chapter 25, 28. It said, Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game. He loved the food that he would bring in from hunting. And sure enough, we see the same thing in our chapter. Look at 27 verses 3 and 4. Isaac sends Esau out to prepare for me delicious food such as I love. And then we see Isaac's love of food repeated again in verse 9. Then we see it again in verse 14. You get the picture, don't you? The food, the food, the food. That is what he's obsessed with. And towards the end of his life, Isaac is becoming a brute beast, a man who is now a slave to his appetites. It's worth reflecting, actually, if this is a danger for us right now. We see that for Isaac, it happened very gradually. So we need to ask the question, am I increasingly driven not by what God says is important, but am I actually driven by my appetites? Is it really my desire for pleasure that drives me, or my desire for luxuries, or my desire for escapism? What is it that I daydream about? What is it that mainly impacts my downtime? What is it that impacts my major life decisions? Am I gradually turning into an Isaac? Am I someone who actually puts appetites above what is truly valuable? That's the warning here. Okay, so where have we got to? We've seen Esau, we've seen Isaac. Next up, the mother, Rebecca. And I've suggested that she is one who thinks the end justifies the means. Now, Rebecca, we know from chapter 25, verse 28, has always loved the little boy, Jacob, the most. And she's the activist. And so as soon as she hears what Isaac said to Esau in verse 5, she immediately springs into action, verse 6, and she comes up with this devious plan to enable Jacob to get the blessing instead of Esau. And of course, what she wants is the right thing. Jacob should be the one who gets the blessing. We know that. But of course, the way she goes about it is all wrong. So rather than being a helper to her husband and gently confronting Isaac and helping Isaac to see what it is that he needs to do to cooperate with God's purposes, instead, Rebecca sets out to deceive and to manipulate her husband. One writer describes Rebecca like this: she is the patron saint of all who serve a helpless God. You know the sort of thing, God has got no hands but our hands, no feet but our feet, no schemes but our schemes. You know, that poor God, he's got some good ideas, but he needs a lot of help to get those ideas across the line. That's the sort of perspective that Rebecca has. Now, I've described Rebecca here as believing the end justifies the means. And you see what I mean? The end, which is the destination, getting the blessing for Jacob, that's the right thing to do. For Rebecca, at least, that justifies the means, the pathway of lying and cheating, which is the wrong way to get there. You know, so long as what I want is ultimately good, what does it matter how I get there? I think there's a real danger of this mindset. I was thinking in Christian ministry. I know this temptation myself. We're so keen in Christian ministry on getting to the right end point. You know, we want whatever it is, church growth perhaps, or small group attendance, or more people serving, or more people giving, or more people signed up to camp. It could be anything. But rather than trusting God's means of getting there, especially prayer, and also patiently teaching the truth, trusting that God will change people in his time, the temptation in Christian ministry is always to try and give poor God a helping hand. And there's ways to do it. You can just put a little bit of pressure on people. You can just guilt trip them a little bit. You can exaggerate the needs. You can slightly twist the truth. You can create an environment quite easily where it's hard to say no. And, you know, I'm aware of this temptation in a church context, but I'm sure you can translate it into lots of different contexts. Even as I speak, you're thinking of, you know, where it is that I might be slipping into being a Rebecca. Where is it that I basically think the end, the good end, justifies the slightly dodgy means to get there? That's where we are. Esau, Isaac, Rebecca. And final one is Tom Hiddleston. Jacob, who chooses ambition over patient faith. Okay, Jacob, who chooses ambition over patient faith. And Jacob is actually the central character in this whole section. He's the main character right up to chapter 35 and beyond. And this moment, what happens in this chapter, is going to define Jacob's life for the rest of his days. It's a really big moment for him. And yet, strangely, it all happens so fast. His mother, she comes up with the idea. She suggests the deception. And then I think what is striking here is that there's no pushback from Jacob, despite the fact that it's his own father and his own brother that he's going to betray. In fact, Jacob's only concern in verse 12 is not the ethics of it at all, but just whether he might get caught. You know, what if my dad is angry? What if Isaac brings a curse upon me, myself, and not a blessing? That's what he's worried about. But of course, the reason Jacob is so easy to get on board with the deception is because he has been waiting for something like this. He's been wanting an opportunity like this for a long time. We saw it back in chapter 25. When he caught his brother at his most vulnerable, Esau had come in from hunting. He immediately had the idea and got Esau to swap his birthright for a bowl of stew. Right from those days, Jacob's ambition was everything. That is what really drives him day by day. And in the heading, I put that Jacob chooses ambition over patient faith. Let me explain what I mean. The reality is that Because God has declared the older will serve the younger, clearly God will bring about the blessing of Jacob. He will get the cookie eventually in his own timing, in God's own way. It's actually a gift God wants to give to him. So you can see that Jacob's sin is not that he wants this thing. The blessing is a good gift. The sin is that he grabs the grubby shortcut and he grabs prematurely by lying the very thing that the Lord longs to give him. And actually, as we zoom out, this moment where he chooses ambition over patient faith, there he is deceiving his father. Actually, it's a massive theme right across the book of Genesis and indeed the whole Bible. I think it's worth just thinking about this together. In some ways, I think this is a lens on all kinds of sins that we're tempted to. Lots of sin has this quality to it. Take, for example, chapter 16, Abraham's sin of having a child with Hagar. We've already looked at this. You can look it up on the website. We've covered this already. God had promised that he would give Abraham and Sarah a child, but you'll remember it was just taking too long. And so what did they do? But they decided to help poor God out a bit. And Abraham had a child with Sarai's servant, Hagar, just to speed things up. And we saw there it was a grubby shortcut. Or take another sin, the archetypal sin back in chapter 3, Adam's sin in the garden. Now, arguably, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which is what they took from, is something, arguably, they would have had access to eventually anyway. Later in the Bible, the knowledge of good and evil is what King Solomon prays for in 1 Kings 3, so that he might govern the people in wisdom. And the Lord is pleased with Solomon's request, and he grants it to him. So it seems this is a good gift, the knowledge of good and evil, which the Lord would have gladly given to humanity when the time was right, when they were mature, when they were ready for it. And so one of the aspects of Adam and Eve's sin was that they were grabbing prematurely something that God was going to give them eventually. They weren't waiting patiently. And of course, it's this same kind of sin, same kind of temptation, which Jesus resists famously in the wilderness. Do you remember in the wilderness, Jesus is there and the devil is tempting him and he offers him all the kingdoms of this world if Jesus will just bow down and worship. And it's a brilliant temptation because it's exactly why Jesus has come. Psalm 2 promises him, or his father promises him in Psalm 2, that he will grant him the nations as his inheritance. The ends of the earth as his possession. This is what Jesus has come to receive. And that is why the temptation is so difficult. It's something that is so good that God has promised him. But of course, the tempter said, why not grab it prematurely? Why not avoid the cross and, you know, the difficult pathway? You don't have to go the suffering and pain route. Just have it now. Just bow down to me now and you can have it immediately. Why wait? And so the point is that Jacob's temptation here is a perspective, isn't it, on lots of ways we sin. So often this is what sin does. It's the decision to take something that is good, something our Father longs to give us. Success or pleasure or honor or relief from suffering or justice, good things that the Father will give to his children eventually. But instead, sin is where we snatch the gift prematurely and disobediently rather than waiting patiently for our Father's good timing. And that is why the key to fighting sin, I hope you're discovering what the key to fighting sin is faith. So often we think the key is willpower, which doesn't get you very far. But if you have faith, if you trust your Father is good, if you trust your Father will give you every good gift in his timing, then I don't have to grab it in advance. And actually, the next time we face that temptation, we can remind ourselves of who God is. We can remind ourselves of a promise that God has given us, like Psalm 84, verse 11. No good thing does he withhold from him who walks uprightly. You can decide in that moment to fight the sin, not just with willpower, which so often loses, but actually with faith. And we can trust our Father and we can resist the temptation. I always think the promise of sin is a little bit like the promise of a McDonald's. The promise of a McDonald's, specifically when you're, let's say it's Christmas Day, and you're on your way to your mother's Christmas lunch, the best meal you're going to have all year. Incidentally, this this illustration doesn't work for everyone because my children would rather the McDonald's. But you got to go with me on this, okay? The point is, there is something wonderful, and it's over the horizon, and it is coming. And therefore, it would be completely mad to settle for plastic food, you know, that you know is not going to satisfy and will lead you to regret in an hour's time. And this is the situation here. This is the temptation for Jacob. He's choosing to grab now what will be his eventually if he will just patiently wait. And therefore, he's sinning against God and he's causing all kinds of trouble for himself. Okay, so where have we got to? Well, here is God's chosen family. What you've got with these four people is God's solution to all that is wrong in this world, encapsulated in this family. Here is God's church on earth. You've got all of them there, all four of them. And yet every one of them is actually a mess, aren't they? There's no good character in this passage. And yet the amazing thing is that despite the mess that sin creates, wonderfully, and we'll look at this more briefly, God's purposes still win. One of the extraordinary things in this passage is that somehow God's purpose, you remember that predicted in chapter 25, the older will serve the younger, that purpose still ends up getting fulfilled despite all the sin and the mess. In fact, it's not just despite the sin, but actually in spite of the direct opposition to the plan. Isaac knows what the plan is. He knows the Lord's will is that Jacob should have the blessing. And yet Isaac doesn't simply try and defy the Lord. What he does is clever. Well, he thinks it's clever. He gives such an extraordinarily large blessing to Esau, as he thinks, that there'll be none left for the other son. That's why Esau is so upset in verse 38, because it's all gone to one son. And yet, as we know, the Lord uses the very action by which Isaac thinks he's going to really stitch God up and defy God's purposes. He uses that very action to fulfill God's plans, unbeknownst to him. I think I've mentioned before, one of my favorite TV shows of the last few years is this one, Lupin. And it's about a master thief called Aslan Diop. And he's masterfully played by Omar Sy. And in the opening episode of the third series, Diop, who's France's most wanted man, and he has a huge online fan base, he declares what he's going to do is steal the priceless black pearl from the high security Place Vendôme next Friday at 10 p.m. And you can imagine what happens. You know, the press get hold of it. The nation's media starts counting down the days. What's going to happen on Friday? And there's huge crowds and the police are gathered in huge numbers outside the high security museum where the pearl is kept. And the minutes tick down and eventually it gets to 10 o'clock. And we're all thinking, what's going to happen? And I won't tell you the plot, but he succeeds. I haven't given away much. You know what was going to happen. But he doesn't just succeed. He succeeds through such an elaborate plan with the unwitting help of the very security services who are trying desperately to oppose him, that you get to the end of it and your jaw drops and you realize, wow, he's the guy. This is the guy who really, really knows what he's doing. He is in total control and you can trust his words. When he says something, you know what will happen. And this is what God does in this chapter. He uses Isaac's attempts to defy God to achieve God's purposes. The super large blessing he intended for Esau ends up landing on Jacob. And God is a specialist at this. And I've put up the verse there of how God achieved this same thing on the cross. So in Acts 13, the Apostle Paul says this: the people of Jerusalem and their rulers did not recognize Jesus. That is, they didn't acknowledge him. They didn't. They rejected his claim. And it goes on. Yet in condemning him, they fulfilled the words of the prophets that are read every Sabbath. It's almost comical, isn't it? You know, the very people who are most opposed to Jesus, who incidentally had been hearing God's plan described week by week, you know, Sabbath by Sabbath for their whole lives, they knew exactly what God's plans were. And these are the guys who God uses to unwittingly fulfill his great salvation plans, like Isaac does here. And they decide to get Jesus nailed to the cross. Hooray, we've won. And yet, you know what happens? He was nailed up on the cross for our sins, and it brought the great triumph, the salvation of the world. And our jaws drop, and we realize that this God really, really knows what he's doing. Therefore, we can really, really trust him. He can use even the worst plans of his enemies and incorporate them into his glorious victory. Now, it's worth saying, if all we knew was that these headings, despite the mess that sin creates, God's purposes still win, I think we'd be tempted to think, well, if God's going to get his plans done anyway, does it really matter? You know, does it matter if I cooperate or not? Why don't I sin that grace may abound, as it says later in the Bible? But these chapters also underline how sin's consequences are very real. In fact, for each of those four people involved, this incident now casts a shadow over the rest of their lives in different ways. They shouldn't have done it. Just like Adam's sin in the garden, it has real and terrible consequences. And we're going to see that worked out in the next weeks. But for now, the wonderful take home for each of us, and it is wonderful, is that the Bible is very realistic. The Bible is honest about the reality of sin, even amongst the people of God, not just the people out there. And therefore, we don't need to be thrown by this fact when we discover that there is real sin within the church and actually real sin within each of us. And if you haven't discovered that, you will. And this should be a real sadness to us, but not a surprise. And God has led us again and again, and especially here, to expect this. The church, as you'll discover, is full of sinners. Some who are actual frauds and pretending to be something they're not, but lots and lots who are just works in progress, as we all are. And yet, wonderfully, even though we face real consequences for our sin, God's purposes for us and for our world really are glorious, and they are unstoppable. And that means that even in the midst of the mess, we really can cling to God, and we can have real confidence and hope in his glorious victory to come. I'm going to leave a chance for us to reflect on this in the quiet. Maybe there'll be some things we want to say to God. Maybe there's some things we need to confess and resolve to trust him in. But why not have this moment quiet, do business with our Saviour?